Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the episode-by-episode breakdown of Red Dwarf. I'm Fergus, and I'm the kind of smeghead who watches the whole series at least once a year.
And I'm John. This podcast is my first time rewatching the show in decades. And we're not the only living beings on this ship, because we're joined every ep by a special guest, and by Alex, who produces the hell out of this mess. This time, we're chatting Series 1, Episode 3, Balance of Power, with Suze Kempner.
Come on, John, let's get out there and twat it.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company had evolved out of the hologram he hates. Plus a fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
We are so lucky to have this guest. She is objectively among the funniest and most talented people around. She's a lauded singer, appearing in cabarets, musical reviews, and collaborating with the likes of Richard Thomas, for crying out loud. She's a superb award-winning comedian with Edinburgh shows and stand-up specials available right now online.
Yep.
She's an accomplished actor, recently playing Doom in Doctor Who, and completing a West End run with Adam Kay. But above all else, she's a Red Dwarf fan. It's Suze Kempner!
Hey!
Thank
Welcome.
You. I like that. Above all else, Red Dwarf
Thank
fan.
You. Well, for us, for our purposes.
It's yeah,
the,
of course.
It's the main credential for this show.
For our listener, it is the key credential you have right now, but then they'll go and find out more about you after the show. Oh, right, well, it's not just being a fan of Red Dwarf. She can sing. She is funny.
It's real. It was all real.
So what about this show? How did you... Do you remember when you first got into it?
So I joined like a new class when I was 9, and someone who I was sat like put next to called Lauren, she loved Red Dwarf. Like, she was obsessed with Red Dwarf, and she said, have you seen Red Dwarf? And I hadn't. And then the next day she brought in her VHS box set of season 1, like 2 videos. And then I took them home, watched them, and I was obsessed. But I also really wanted to impress her. So I was like sort of determined to like it, like impress my new friend in the class. But I just thought, oh, this is brilliant. And it's really nice to grow with it, because that's like coming up on 30 years. Yeah. And it's nice to grow with Red Dwarf and go, no, this is great for reasons I didn't even realise. It's great, yeah.
That's really cool that you could start from season 1 as well.
Yeah,
at that
yeah.
point, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Was it pressing buttons that you already liked, sci-fi or comedy, or was the whole shebang new to you at that age?
I grew up in a household with a lot of comedy on VHS, like stand-up and Victoria Wood. And we had Victoria Wood and Fawlty Towers, and we had an Eddie Murphy video, which I probably shouldn't have been watching. and like on cassette, things like Round a Horn and Derek and Clive, which is definitely shouldn't have been listened
to. Wow.
So I was listening to Derek and Clive when I was nine.
Oh, God, that was good stuff, though.
Yeah. I don't think it was for adults.
No.
I think it was for 9-year-olds.
Yeah, like, I think you're right.
It's so silly
and
sweary.
It's still good. But yeah, Red Dwarf did fit, right? Blackadder and, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it wasn't like, this is my first sitcom. And my mum, when I brought it home, I said, I got these. Someone borrowed me these. And my mum was like, oh, Red Dwarf's brilliant. So,
oh, yeah, wow. Awesome. Okay.
She already loved it. Yeah.
And that didn't put you off it?
No, I was desperate to impress mother.
So was there, how did you feel about the sci-fi? Sci-fi, take it or leave it? Or was that the key that kind of galvanised the comedy for you?
I don't think I've ever been like a big sci-fi buff in any way. This has been said a billion times. It's really not an original point, but the best thing about Red Dwarf is it works so brilliantly as a sitcom. Mm. Particularly with season one, there's so much of the sit in sitcom there, so that the sci-fi elements are just part of that, rather than a sci-fi show with jokes in it.
If you were a writer working out how to trap an odd couple together,
yeah,
you can't go wrong. You can't get much better than a spaceship 3 million years
exactly,
away from Earth.
Exactly. Yeah, there's literally nowhere to go for either of them, and yeah, it's weirdly instantly recognisable the moment you start watching it. Mm. It does it also brilliantly. I know we're not talking about the pilot today, but I think the pilot of Red Dwarf, I've used that as like teaching an example of a perfect pilot for a sitcom. Every single character sort of arrives fully formed. They build the world almost instantly. That's brilliant. That's what you want from a sitcom, definitely.
Tell us more. Please feel free to talk about whatever episodes you want, especially in this bit of the episode, the podcast. Because I agree. It's so tight.
Yeah. Absolutely. We spend 10 minutes meeting this workplace, this very mundane workplace set in a recognisable future, even though like we can't comprehend it. Because it may as well be on some industrial ship somewhere in the sea.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
And
for the first couple of series, definitely.
Yeah. So that first 10 minutes really sets up a lot. In that time, we see a funeral and we see how they handle a funeral and how in the future you don't grieve in the same way. And we just buy it because they present it with such mundanity that we just buy it immediately. So that when we see Lister wake up having been asleep for 3 million years and they say, well, we've got you someone back, and then we see it's Rimmer walking, we know what that is. We're like, oh yeah, that's the hologram from earlier. Never feel it's been seeded for us, but it's not like being like crammed down our necks. We don't watch the funeral of George and him coming back as a hologram and go, oh, I see, this is going to happen later in the episode with one of the main characters. So yeah, it's just everything about is brilliant. I met Jenna Russell, who is an incredibly accomplished theatre performer and TV performer. She's been in EastEnders. I mean, if you ever do an EastEnders podcast, have me back. one of her first jobs was she sang the theme tune.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, you should get her on. She's so funny. But she says, she always says, the job, whatever job she's doing, by about day three, someone will go, is it true that? That's you singing the Red Dwarf theme tune. And she said she can't believe it because it was essentially 2 hours of work.
Yeah, of course.
When she was about
21.
And
presumably, she must have been absolutely baffled when she saw the programme.
Yes, she
imagine
was.
Seeing those lyrics before seeing the programme, then watching the programme going, did they make a mistake? They've put the wrong song on the wrong show.
Yeah, and I was starstruck when I met her, not because she's won Olivier's and played Dot in Sunday in a Park with George. I was like, it's the woman from the Red Dwarf theme tune.
it's so instantly recognised. Dun, 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 dun. It's everything about that piece of music. Irresistible and undeniable. Even to the extent that John and I were out yesterday on the South Bank and he went, oh, it's cold outside.
Yeah.
And you can't say those three words without going, it's not kind of...
I've got to finish it.
Oh, Jenna Russell, good on her. Because I've never seen her name in the credits. It's always...
She would have just been a session singer.
And I do love that the opening title sequence that uses a really cut down, bleak orchestral version of that same tune.
Yes.
Do you like that?
I love it. Yeah, I prefer that to the fun electric guitar, which feels more 90s. That feels more 90s, whereas the original from 88 just really feels like timeless. It feels like it could be from 80 years ago. It could be 200 years in the future. It's, yeah, brilliant.
We've been talking in previous episodes about how it's quite surprising to start a sitcom with something that bleak.
Yeah.
But actually, I think the 80s were a time of doing that. Do you remember a sitcom called Dear John?
No, I don't know Dear John.
Started with the song, Dear John.
I do vaguely remember.
By the time you read these words, I'll be gone. And it's like, whoa.
Oh, God, the Birds of a Feather theme tune was very sad as well, wasn't it?
Will I do? Yeah, it's like they both died.
I knew Birds of a Feather was set in
hell.
Heaven. Yeah, right. I was going for the other one. What's the one between? Oh my gosh.
Purgatory.
There we go. Do you have a favourite performance or character in Red Dwarf?
Oh no, when I was a kid, I was all about the cat. I thought it was amazing. And I do think that performance is brilliant, obviously, particularly in season one when he really is a cat. But as an adult, I just think Chris Barry's performance as Rimmer is... this is going to sound wrong because... I think the show's brilliant, but it's almost too good for the show because it's better than it needs to be because the dialogue is already great. But what he does with that character is just phenomenal. And I feel like if he was an American actor in an American show and he was doing that, he'd be on like 8 Emmys and they'd have put him in huge films. I think he's amazing outside of Red Dwarf as well. I just think he's one of our most underrated actors, and I think it's quite nice that he's sort of in his later career gone, oh well, I'll just do Red Dwarf for a couple of months of the year and spend the rest of the time having my quite nice life.
I think he does have quite a nice life driving classic cars and talking about classic cars. I think that's his thing now, right?
What a dream, yeah. It's like that thing where what a lesson to all of us. Like, oh yeah, he felt like he had enough success and that'll do. Whereas I wouldn't be like that. I'd be going, well, I'm gonna have one more go at crack in America or something.
I was just talking to Alex about the idea that. I think there must be an age. It's not about losing ambition, but it feels like there's an age where you just get to be okay with what you've done.
Right, yeah, which right? must be Hopefully. What's happened.
It might be an age thing, or it might be being in something that has a convention circuit attached to it.
Right.
Because then you know, if you're a bit short, you can always go and tap into some of that sweet
signed photo
money.
Oh,
yes.
That sweet convention money.
Well, I'm hoping I'll be able to get on that myself.
I think you will.
That would be quite nice. I love sitting down.
Sitting down and writing your own name.
That's it. Yeah, I can do that. I've been doing that for years. I've been doing that for 15 years, being able to sit down and write my own name. Perfect.
What is it about Rimmer? It is Chris Barry's performance. He is a despicable person, but he's... You can't stop watching him. There's something fascinating about him. When he really sinks to the depths of like Better Than Life, where he's given the opportunity to have whatever he wants and ends up creating a nightmare for himself.
Yeah.
How are we still watching him? How come we're like, oh yeah, more of this, please. More of this. Is it because of Lister? Is it because the two of them kind of yin and yanging each other?
Obviously, they're an amazing sort of fire and ice, oil and water combo. I think that... The way Rim is written, Chris Barry really digs into the odious side of it, but there's always this slight vulnerability. What I really like about the character is they don't let him off. There's not this idea that... Because he constantly says, well, I never stood a chance. And everything we learn about him, particularly in those first 6 seasons, everything we learn about him, you go, oh, yeah, no, you could have been so much more. And the show actively says that. And well, you don't see that. You don't see that on camera you don't see that in sitcoms even with a character who we're meant to like. It's not even we hate him, but we love to watch him. Like, you do find yourself going like, oh, I guess I like you.
Especially British. In British comedy, we like people who fail because they're shit. The tragic character, right? The definition of tragedy, where you're causing your own downfall.
Yes.
Your own neuroses and your own ambition and all that stuff.
He's so resilient in his unpleasantness. Yeah. Like, he will not change. It doesn't matter what happens to him, he will not change.
Yeah.
But he will every now and again pretend to change for about 30 seconds to see if he can get something he wants.
Yes.
And then immediately the mask comes off.
He's
constantly finding new ways to be unpleasant.
Yes.
Mind you, I think Lister gives him... Lister is obviously a beautiful and positive and humanist character, but occasionally he gives Rimmer a run for his money.
Oh, yeah.
Cross-referencing like Marooned in Series 3, where mm-hmm. he cuts a guitar shape mm-hmm. out of Rimmer's trunk and pretends mm-hmm. it is. Lister's a bad person.
It's a proper piece of shit behaviour, isn't it? Yeah.
Do you think it is a British thing as well? Like, I was thinking about the fact that one of the reasons maybe this whole concept didn't work in America, in spite of America loving an Odd Couple, mm-hmm. is that Rimmer is there to keep Lister sane. And the idea that antagonism would engender peace somehow, yeah, like mental, right. spiritual peace... Mm-hmm. Mm. I think is a lot easier to swallow if you've lived in Thatcher's Britain.
Yeah, which we were bang in the middle of at this point, I guess, yeah. So I always use the example because the Red Dwarf, they never made it work in America for various reasons. They were like, what is it, one sort of real dodgy pilot and then this cheap-ass taster thing they made with a different cast, and it just wouldn't work. The example I always use is how it wouldn't work. So they remade Fawlty Towers in America with Bea Arthur, and it was called something Amanda's, Staying at Amanda's, or maybe it was just called Amanda's.
I flipping love Bea Arthur. Like,
yeah, I mean,
I really do.
She is. She is a queen, but so she was playing the Basil Fawlty role. And in the episode... where, you know, there's a body, they're trying to hide a body throughout in Fawlty Towers. They recreate that episode with a sort of tweaked script with Bea Arthur running around as Basil Fawlty going, oh, no. And at the end of the episode, the body was just asleep and drunk and it comes back to life.
Oh.
And that's the difference between Britain and America. In America, they couldn't allow it to just be, it was a corpse all along. The twist has to be, and he was alive, it's all right, everything's all right.
Fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah, whereas in Fawlty Towers, a guy dies in the night.
Oh, yeah.
And he's dead. Yeah.
You can see he is dead. He's pale and bloated by the time we find him.
Yes.
Jesus.
It wouldn't, like, that episode wouldn't be a classic if at the end of it, Basil's like, and he's alive. Like, and he goes, oh, he was alive the whole time.
Oh, my gosh. And therefore, everything we just did had no stakes. And
exactly,
therefore no
exactly. Yeah.
And I will never want to see this episode again. No. But you know what? That said, I'd love to see Bea Arthur as Basil Fawlty. I suspect she's
fun.
She's got too much strength to play Fawlty, though, surely.
Like, yeah, that's it as well. Like, America wouldn't allow people to be that pathetic. It's one of where there's been a lot of... I'm a big, like, spokesperson for Friends, I think it's... brilliantly tightly written and as problematic as many things that are nearly 30 years old. The scripts are so tightly written, I think the chemistry of that cast is largely unmatched. What they do well, and it doesn't get talked about enough, is, yeah, everyone's too good looking and, you know, they all look like beautiful 90s actors, because guess what? It was a beautiful 90s actor sitcom. But they still have a character like Ross, who is... really pathetic. Like, he's pathetic and we still like him. That doesn't happen that much in American sitcoms, that we really root for someone that pathetic. Other examples would be, I guess, like Niles in Frasier. Like, he's kind of a pathetic, flawed character, but we
really
love
interesting,
him.
Interesting, yeah.
We don't see it that much in America.
I think Red Dwarf is a lot more British than Rob Grant and Doug Naylor actually wanted it to be.
Right.
With reference in this episode, with the flashbacks, you've got Lister's mates are called Peterson and Chen and
Selby.
And McAllister, the captain's American.
Yeah.
And they've got Esperanto written on the walls in the background.
Yeah.
Again, this is a tough question, but what is it about the show that makes you go, no, this is British. This is very British. In spite of their best efforts, this is a very British show.
Yeah. The most obvious thing is, I guess, they all look like real people. They don't look like the cast of Friends. Like, if they made Friends in Britain, that wouldn't work, because we always have to have some element of dyspepsia for something to be a true classic.
Coupling is so dark. That's right? The closest we've ever come.
Because they made an American Coupling, and it's like, why have you done this?
God,
like, what's
did
the
they?
Point?
Surely Coupling was British Friends.
Exactly, and like I say, we had to make it like kind of horrible. You look at sitcoms from around that era. Things like Ever-Degreasing Circles was just like, just misery and misery of one man's own making, basically. Like,
does it come down to schadenfreude then? Like, because taking another step back, we're looking at Steptoe and Hancock. Hancock was just not much fun to watch in Hancock's half-hat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
a miserable bloke complaining. Clearly, yes. Clearly suffering from acute depression.
That's it, yes.
But just unrecognised and undiagnosed. So it's comedy.
My boyfriend is a comedian in Toronto and he was brought up on British comedy like so many people in North America were. And he always said, he laments sitcoms now that are so keen for everything to be nice. It has to be quite nice. So you've got Schitt's Creek, but it's okay. Don't worry. Everything's really nice. Everything's ultimately really nice. I have no issue with Schitt's Creek, but that is true. Once it's seen, it can't be unseen. I sort of feel the same way about Ted Lasso. I don't know what this says about me, but I can't get too invested in something where I know ultimately it's all just going to work out and they're all going to be really cute about things. Like, because where's the true conflict there?
Right. I think, Alex, John, am I allowed to say my thing about American Red Dwarf?
Yeah, go for it.
In the British first episode of Red Dwarf,
yes.
Lister comes in. On finding out that he's been in stasis for 3 million years, he goes, 3 million years? I still got that library book.
Mm.
In the American pilot, the equivalent line is, 3 million years? My baseball cards are going to be worth a fortune.
Mm.
And for me, that does exactly what you were just talking about, that fundamental difference between American and British. Like, the American wins. Lister is better off for having been in stasis for 3 million years.
That's it. Yeah, it's true.
Let's get to the hard stuff. When did you stop watching Red Dwarf? Or did you?
I watched 7 and 8 because I guess I was a teenager, 12 and 14, I think, when those seasons came out. And I very much remember making myself like them. And I did a huge... And that was it. I then watched the three-parter Back to Earth. And I didn't even hate it, but I went, yeah, I'm all right checking out. And I've got a friend who still watches it. And he says, there's a couple of episodes of the new stuff where it's almost as good as old Red Dwarf, and it's one of those things. I'll just take his word for it. I don't really need to see like a facsimile of this show that I used to that I still love. Like I loved it so much.
That's a very apposite word to use because it doesn't feel like an extension necessarily. Right. I'm a bit of an apologist for the new series. Mm-hmm, there are some jokes that really land really well. There's good writing in it,
yeah.
But what you're talking about is undeniable.
Right.
They can't move forward with it. Mm-hmm. There is fan appeasement going on. And as soon as you have that... And Red Dwarf's always had a bit of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Dwayne Dibley coming back.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there are definitely problems in season 5 and 6, if you can call them problems, where it is that thing. People are so familiar with the show and they love the studio audience. You can hear them. They're like, ah, they're vibrating with how much they love the show. Watching as a kid... Obviously, I would be like, season 6 is my favourite because Dwayne Dibley comes back, like you say.
Yeah.
And it's, as I did a big rewatch in lockdown. Hadn't watched Red Dwarf probably in about 10 years. And it was so nice discovering, like, I think I said right at the beginning, like, this show is brilliant for reasons I didn't even realise. Like, watching a lot of things in a post-Me Too world can be heartbreaking when you're like, oh, that thing I used to love is horrible. There's definitely elements of that with Friends. And watching Red Dwarf and going, oh, okay, this show, maybe even by accident, because it's like a male team have created it, it's an all-male cast, and somehow... It's like they knew what incels were going to be way off in the future. And I was like, God, I can love it even more. I didn't even know. I found the same thing with Goodfellas, which was my favourite film from when I first saw it. I was 15. And then I hadn't watched it for a few years and went on my birthday about 4 years ago. They were showing it at the Prince Charles Cinema. Beautiful, beautiful old print that they had. And so I went and watched it with that same sort of trepidation. Like, what if I watch this? And I'm like, oh, yeah, no, it's just shit, man, isn't it? I watched it. I was like, oh, no, Scorsese got it. Like, there's a bit in Goodfellas where Joe Pesci's girlfriend, it's Ileana Douglas, or mistress or wife. Anyway, the camera's sort of panning across everyone and he's gesticulating at her and shouting at her and then he walks away. And she turns to her friend and goes, he gets so jealous. If I even looked at another man, he'd kill me. And the friend goes, oh, that's great. There's no way Scorsese didn't know exactly what he was doing with that. These shows that knowingly are about toxic masculinity and these films that are knowingly about it, sort of years ahead of their time, that mean they can improve with age. I think Red Dwarf is definitely that. particularly in those first seasons.
Is there a particular era or series that stands out for you in Red Dwarf? So assuming 1 to 6 somewhere.
I'm sort of sad about this because this rewatch showed me that I don't think the show was ever as good for me as it was in season one.
Oh my gosh.
Right. I love everything about season one Red Dwarf, and I love Crichton, I love Robert Llewellyn's performance, and if he'd been in season one of Red Dwarf, no issues whatsoever. To have have your second ever episode of your sitcom be Future Echoes, it kind of doesn't get much better than that. That they perfectly explain the sci-fi element, which is very high concept, and it doesn't involve time travel strictly, but time travel adjacent stuff is notoriously hard to make understandable on screen. You know, I gave myself a headache watching Looper in the cinema, for example. But I think, yeah, like I say, to have the second episode of your show be Future Echoes, that is bold. And I think that's bolder than something like, say, Polymorph, which is kind of, I really like Polymorph and I love what it does with the characters, and there is like deep dive stuff into the characters, like people losing their guilt and people losing their shame. But Polymorph is mainly a parody of Alien. Confidence and paranoia, I'll always have that higher than Polymorph, because confidence and paranoia is like hardcore psychological stuff and really funny. And they put in two guest stars without you going, oh, there's two new actors on this, you know, there's two new people for them to interact with, and I'm not used to it, because we were so used to the fact that it's just these people on this ship. That's the whole point of the show.
That's really true. I'd not even considered that. It is mold breaking, but it's never a problem.
You don't judge it.
The writing is just so robust. If you can do Future Echoes as your second, like you're saying, like that, the fact that the audience didn't quit at that point is a sign that these guys are really good at what they're doing.
That's it. Yeah, exactly it.
I've got one last little question before we talk about balance of power specifically. Mm. It's a bit of a contentious question because obviously Craig Charles, Chris Barry, Robert Llewellyn, Danny John-Jules, they are irreplaceable, but if you had to replace them, how would you recast this show for a current day reboot?
It is a great question. Well, in sort of honour of Grant and Naylor's idea that it would be this very international feeling sitcom, why not put David Schwimmer in as in the Chris Barry role? Put him as Rimmer. I think that would be sort of an interesting performance, and it would get round the American gloss side of things, because I think David Schwimmer is just brilliant. I think he's amazing, and I think
he does play harder than Ross.
I think he's the best friend. Yeah,
me too. In his series five. Season five performance is incredible.
Oh God, he is so good.
Where he starts to lose his mind a little bit,
and
he's not in Friends. Yeah, he can play harder as well, like hard. He's good. Stonier,
he can.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, he's very good. I thought he was brilliant in Band of Brothers. Where he plays a character sort of so unlike Ross, but we're so used to Ross from Friends, it would be easy for us to go, hey, look, it's the guy who's Ross from Friends. But I never did when watching Band of Brothers. Anyway, so I think that would be interesting casting. Far as the cat goes, there's a guy that, he's not famous. There's a guy who's famous in musical theatre. I was lucky enough to work with a few years ago called Cedric Neal, who's a absolutely brilliant singer. He's American, and I think he's so funny and he's so off the wall funny. I'd love to see what he would do with the cat. That's Cedric Neal.
Is Cedric Neal a physical guy? Like, is he?
He's a very physical performer. Yeah, brilliant. And I think he'd be fantastic. Now, in terms of Lister, I don't know how well this would work, but I think maybe someone, because I'm thinking about, like, they shoot it in around that time, the 80s or early 90s, someone like Ade Edmondson.
Oh my gosh.
Could you see it? I could see it.
Yeah, I can see it.
Yeah.
He was very busy playing very, very violent psychopaths at the time. But actually, his real life persona is so gentle and so lovely and positive. And he could.
Yeah, I could see it. I could just see it. Now, it gets harder with Holly because I just think Norman Lovett makes the perfect computer. But I'd sort of like flip it. Someone like Alexei Sayle.
someone who's the opposite of a computer, someone who's just
This
is stupid, and you know my performance is going to let you know this is stupid. Like
that's it. Like we're stirring shit up now because we know we'd never recast this. Part of the brilliance of the show is the alchemy of this cast's chemistry. Even when they weren't liking each other, it was sort of perfect. So I think as we're doing season one, that's where I'd go with
it. Could you not almost map the Young Ones cast onto the Red Dwarf cast? Like you're only two steps away from putting Rick Mayall as Rimmer, and
Nigel Planner as Crichton.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
So much guilt.
Amazing. There we go.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's stop general chat and talk about this awesome episode. John, tell us about it.
Let's get super specific. Right, Balance of Power, or to give it its friend's title then, it's the one with the 4,691 irradiated haggis, I guess. So Lister reveals the grand plan that will be threaded intricately throughout every story arc for the next 35 years and counting. Go back to Earth, and in the meantime, slop around, have a few laughs. Take that, Babylon 5. Rimmer has hidden the cigarettes. He's rationing them in line with behaviour to exert control over Lister. Holly explains that he chose to bring Rimmer back as Lister's sole companion because he is the best person to keep Lister sane. After all, they exchanged over 14 million words compared to the paltry 173 words that Lister exchanged with Christine Kachansky. Lister is feeling deeply alone and unloved. Rimmer refuses to be switched off for 4 hours to allow Lister to try his luck on a date with Kachansky's hologram, and furthermore, he's hidden the hologram discs. So Lister nicks Rimmer's old learning drugs and tries to pass the chef's exam in order to outrank him. Brilliant. Rimmer is distracted by some Sam Raimi-esque antics involving Peterson's arm, but this ordeal clearly gives him an idea. The devious gimboid visits Lister mid-exam in the holographic body of Kachansky. Rimchansky drops a bomb. I just don't like you. I'm not going to do the voice. I just don't like you, he says in Kachansky's voice. I need a man who's going places. Up, up the ziggurat, lickety split. Triggered by the extraordinary phrase, I'm having a woman's period, Lister sees through this performance and realises this is not Mike Kachansky. Not long after, an anxious Rimmer watches as Lister gets his exam results. He's passed! Now everything is going to change for good. Unless we find out next week he was just messing around. Susan Fergus, white card, let's get into Balance of Power. Black card, first some trivia. BBC apparently wanted a straight sitcom episode because they didn't want the show to be too heavy on the sci-fi, and Balance of Power was apparently Grant Naylor's response to that. Readers of the Red Dwarf Smegazine considered this the weakest episode of season one. It received just 0.1% of the votes in the readers' poll.
Just the 6 episodes of series one?
For out of the season one.
What?
I'm sure it was parcelled up with other seasons at the time of the poll. I can't believe it was that unpopular just within season one.
I've got a theory as to why that might be.
Well, go for it. Yeah. What is that?
I think it's the ending. I saw this as it was being transmitted. That meant I spent a week wondering how Lister was going to lord it over Rimmer in episode 4. And I reckon it's that disappointment, it's that lack of continuity that maybe bugs people. Because it was the first time they went, hey, we're changing the story, we're changing the dynamic of this whole show. And then the next show it was like, no, we're not.
Yeah, yeah.
So retrospectively disappointing rather than disappointing in and of itself.
The episode itself is brilliant, right?
Well, how disappointing would it be, though, if he had passed, actually?
Yeah, he becomes an officer.
It is a funny one, isn't it? Because plot-wise, on the face of things, there's not loads to dig into on this episode. It kind of like, how well does it fulfil that brief of being a straightforward sitcom episode as much as Red Dwarf can?
The stakes are actually relatively low because he wants to become an officer to outrank Rimmer and then get to spend time with Kachansky, a woman he doesn't know. I've never liked the fact that they then retconned it that they had dated, because, like, no, she wouldn't. She wouldn't have done. She'd barely be aware of him because of his attitude towards her, which was to put her up on a pedestal and never truly approach her in any meaningful way. So what, yeah, he would essentially, like, what he gets when he gets Rimmer as Kachansky talking to him probably isn't a million miles away from what she actually would have felt. She would have been kinder about it, and she wouldn't have said, I'm a bit out of sorts, I'm having a woman's period. But she wouldn't have gone, oh, really, you've held a candle for me this whole time, well, that's amazing. And I think the show knows that as well, so they at this point, yes. I think it's a case of, like, they could never truly meet. This isn't like a love story that we're working towards, and it kind of disappoints me that they did do that.
Yeah. And Lister knows it as well, right? Like, he knows it in the flashback very clearly, and then when she does seemingly appear, that brilliant bit of acting he does when he's holding on to the hot
dish
for too long and then scoop, like, he's so taken aback. This is not a man who's expecting, it's not just because he wasn't expecting a then, it's he's not expecting this to work out at all. The whole thing is a flight of fancy, isn't it?
One of the things I like about it, it speaks highly of Lister's character, that when Rimmer goes, come on, it's Kachansky's body, it's Kachansky's voice, what's the difference?
Yes.
And in not even, like, a really easy, cheap gag that maybe another sitcom would have made would be Lister, like, contemplating, shall I this hologram or like something. Not that that's possible, but you know what I mean? Like, oh, he could have contemplated, like, go on then, take your shirt off or something. No, that wouldn't even cross his mind. The fact is, he goes, no, that's not her, so I'm not interested. Yeah. And I think that speaks highly of Lister, and I think that's something that would be unique to a sitcom like Red Dwarf in 1988.
Yeah, there is a purity to the whole thing, is it? Because he wants to take her on a date. Like, he doesn't, like you say, he doesn't want to just get Kachansky's body back.
No.
He wants to go and have a romantic candlelit
dinner. And yeah, it's his idea of her is what he's in love with. But and this idea that, like, what a shame that they all died while I was in stasis, because I was this close to making her my wife. it's pure fantasy.
Yeah.
There's a sort of immature maturity to the fact that what he wants is to just live a lovely, happy life with Kachansky. Rimmer's sort of envious of that, like, as you say, that purity, because what he fantasizes about is grim and slimy. And as you've said, when he's got that opportunity and better than life, what he does is reject it because he can't have anything nice happen to him. He's happy in his misery.
You've made me aware of something there, Suze, talking about the immaturity of Lister's perception of this non-existent relationship with Kachansky. I think the reason why I was so invested in it when I was watching it as a young teen is precisely because that was all I had as well, like, just the fantasy of a relationship, that was it. So that for me this was just there you go, you just carry a torch with someone, that's what life is.
For an adult show, this does speak to kids really well, doesn't it?
In terms of unrequited love, there's nothing more unrequited than the love you have for someone who's definitely dead.
3 million years ago.
Yeah.
Oh my God, absolutely. Suze, I don't know if I'm going to take us down a blind alley now, but for any listeners that haven't listened to the Queen podcast, now defunct, sadly, but it lives forever.
It was a child of lockdown.
It was a child of lockdown, but it deserves a long half-life. Hearing you talking about Freddie Mercury's vocal techniques is one of life's great pleasures. So go down with
that,
guys. There is some musical stuff in this episode, and so I wondered if it was worth mining for any thoughts that you have on it. I don't imagine there's much of this, but this is the first time, I think, that we actually hear Lister's beloved Rastabilly Skank.
Which appears to
be just basic boogie with shed loads of chorus, very 80s.
Right.
Can you see it catching on? No, that's not the question. I want to know, what would you blend together if you had to create some music of the future?
If I had to create Rastabilly Skank, what is it? The Rimmer's like, it causes bowel problems.
Yes,
it causes you to evacuate your bowels. It would be something as far flung as, like, jungle, as in club jungle, drums and bass, like set with like gamelan music, which I don't know if you've ever heard, but if you heard it, be like, oh yeah, it's that. If you put those together, surely that would cause some sort of bowel issue.
It definitely would. It definitely would, yeah. Do you think that's the direction music is just heading in?
I think we're going to get there eventually, yeah. There are no new ideas.
Trap feels like it's specifically designed to do that, right?
Yeah, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, we've had enough pleasant pop. Well, that's why Motorhead is elevated along with Mozart and Mendelssohn, then.
Yes,
in the future,
yeah.
It just becomes part of the pantheon.
I always really like the joke where Rimmer's like, he's like, you know, Wilfred Shakespeare. I think that's really good. I think that says, it's a silly little joke, but I think it says a lot about Rimmer and a lot about how art and culture is treated in the future.
Right, yeah. Sticking with the musical theme, Lister's disco music, it says, oh, I don't know why it's Lister's disco music.
Oh, yeah, in the
according
flashback.
To Wikipedia, yeah. It's a track called Fakin', and it's by Motor City Diva, who don't appear on Google anywhere other than in relation to Red Dwarf. So I think
okay.
that might be, maybe it's an in-joke or something.
Yeah.
But it's Motor City Diva with Danny John-Jules.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
And you've already mentioned how much you love Cat in the beginning when he's just
in
being a cat.
In season one, yeah.
Right, he's written in quite a narrow lane in the first couple of seasons compared to what he does later on, but he brings so much to every moment. And for me, like, some of the most enjoyable bits of this episode are things like, how am I looking? I'm just a nice period, which just lives rent-free in my head and has done for the last 30 years. What is there stuff when you're watching him? Because obviously his background was dance. He was in the original Starlight Express. Hadn't done loads of telly at this point. As a musical theatre performer, what sort of things are you seeing Danny doing? You know, are there techniques you can identify that he's drawing on to create this indelible TV character with such comparatively little material?
Yeah, I mean, it's an obvious one, but the movement is, that's how a dancer walks. He's so in tune with his body, and he wasn't just a dancer. Like, he was one of the most successful commercial dancers in a period where it was probably extremely difficult, even compared to now, to be a black man working in commercial dance. Like, he had an incredible dance career, even at a pretty young age. He's so in tune with his body, and he's been put in, frankly, ridiculous costumes. And the way he looks completely comfortable in them, I think, is probably what set him apart from everyone else who auditioned. I know the story about how he showed up an hour late and didn't realise he was an hour late and made no apology for it, and they loved that.
Awesome.
That's what a cat would do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a cat is like, well, I will show up when I feel like it, thank you. And then he just said he sort of just went for it in the audition and they loved it, and he is perfect in the role. But yeah, I'm sure if he'd known he was an hour late, he'd have been very apologetic and maybe wouldn't have got it. There's also this, he's completely understands the writing, because the writing of that is brilliant. I mean, what an incredible idea for a character that's so neatly explained by Holly, where he's like, well, you humans evolved from apes, he evolved from cats.
Yeah.
And you don't need many brain cells to go, oh, yeah, no, I totally get what I'm looking at here. And what he really gets with, which is how a cat behaves, Fergus, your cat is on the screen right now, literally being the cat. There's no malice in when he turns around and goes, when the cat priest is going like, oh, why would you care? And the cat goes, I don't care. I don't care. And there's an absolutely, he's not trying to be a piece of saying that. He's going, no, I don't care. I really don't care. It's like almost like a child would be, when a child will say out loud during a dinner when someone's telling a long story, they'll go, I'm very bored. It's not done because they're like, right, I'll get you with this. And the cat sort of does that, because that is what cats are like. They'll walk across your dinner and sort of stumble through. You'd be like, you've just trodden in my gravy and then spotted it all over the lounge. And they'll look round at you and go, I know I did. Why are you being like this about it? And I think that's what Danny John-Jules perfectly gets with the perfect writing of the cat. There's a bit, the bit where Lister sort of passes out when he's got the mutated flu. Passes out and cat passes him and goes, oh, no, you're ill. Oh, bye. He just sort of goes, oh no, look at you, you are not well. And that's as far. He says, if I didn't like you, I'd steal your shoes.
Yeah.
So then we go like, oh, he likes him.
Yeah, that's a great compliment and kindness.
Yeah.
So something we've observed with the series is that the BBC iPlayer, which has currently got all of Red Dwarf on it, is marketing this show to potential viewers in really weird ways. They've got maybe 15 words per episode to give you a little teaser of what the episode is about.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a look at the teaser for Balance of Power, and it begins, cult space comedy series, which you sort of think, well, fair enough, it is that. But that's the only episode it says that about.
Oh.
And when you read on, I think you learn why they felt the need to say that. Cult space comedy series. Lister wants to go on a date with a dead console officer.
I mean...
What?
A bit of context.
All the ways that you could summarise that.
Really? Yeah.
And then, like, marry that up with the title, Balance of Power. What kind of fresh hell is this that we're wading into?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to watch that. I wouldn't want to watch that show.
No. And weird details about a console officer. What was that? What even is a console officer?
Yeah.
What are they talking about?
Yeah, I wouldn't have even clocked. I mean, obviously, I know Kachansky is the console officer on Red Dwarf, but if someone said, describe Kachansky right now, I wouldn't go, well, she was Red Dwarf's console officer.
Exactly.
That's something strange. Yeah.
She was in charge of the consoles. I'm not even sure she was that. But obviously that's not what... that's not really what... That is an element of the plot. But no normal person with a sense of empathy would describe what Lister actually wants in those terms.
Oh, yeah, what an odd choice, yeah.
Really weird.
Unless it's the first part of a very long sentence that goes on to say, but because he's trapped on a spaceship where they can only regenerate one person at a time as a hologram, he has to go through this rigmarole.
Yeah, and someone's gone, that's too long, it won't fit, and they've gone, oh, I'll tell you what, we'll just cut the end bit and put cult space comedy at the beginning.
There you go, yeah.
That way they'll know.
Anyway, what the episode obviously is about, if it's about anything other than being funny, is like what it says in the tin, right? It's the balance of power. There's lots of stuff in there about the balance of power. So at the risk of being a bit Red Dwarf book club with this question,
right.
You've got Rimmer and Lister, you've got Rimmer and the cat with the cigarettes and the bartering, you've got Holly. Do we really believe Rimmer's physical data disk has been corrupted, or is Holly being a bit of a boss there?
Yeah.
You've got the questionable thing with Kachansky being brought back, despite the fact that she outranks everyone, and nobody asks her if she wants to come back to go on a date with Dave. Suze, balance of power, discuss.
Yes, what is so lovely about Lister and Rimmer's, this imbalance of power between the two of them is, yes, Lister is outranked, and so there's many things that he can't request on the ship without Rimmer's say-so. But yeah, Rimmer has no physical abilities, so he can only order the scutters to do stuff for him, and they hate him. Or he can try and get Lister to do stuff. I mean, he tries to get the cat to help him carry Lister later in the series in Confidence of Paranoia, and the cat literally pretends to get up from the table. It's an incredible bit of physical comedy, and very cat-like. The bitterness and frustration he has in that, as he just counts as one more injustice in his life, as like within his death there's even injustice, because now he has no ability to touch. That leaves him powerless, even though he does technically still have the most power on the ship, on paper.
Obviously, in this episode, you've got the threat of the cigarettes being withheld. But it's more than just, you know, Lister is a degenerate addict that can't make it to the first step, isn't it? It's not that. It's on some level, I think Holly's got a point about keeping him sane here, because his grand plan is to just slob about and have a few laughs.
Sit in the cinema and drink beers and
there's a hell of a lot in this episode. We haven't covered all of it, but if you had to pick a best bit, whether it's a best line, a best moment, a best look, a best musical cue, who knows, what for you is the standout part of Balance of Power?
Oh, it's near the end. It's so funny, and it's a physical masterpiece from both of them. Lister is getting his results of the test, and Rimmer is sidling over because he's completely like, he's this could be life-changing for both of them because of the balance of power. So whether Lister passes or fails the exam is so important to Rimmer, and so he's sidling over trying to be casual, and on top of that he's still got a woman's hips, so he's walking over with no dignity whatsoever. He's walking over with a very feminine walk, and Lister sees that and just looks away, and the look away is towards the camera. He doesn't look down the barrel of the camera, and it's so funny, and it really took me by surprise rewatching it, you know, years and years later. I'd sort of forgotten this, and I was like, God, that's so f***ing funny.
Yeah. It is. That look is profound in comedy as well, right? Actually,
yeah.
To make a big old circle of the whole thing, Jennifer Aniston criticises Ross in Friends for doing that when an awkward thing happens. She says, yeah, go on, just look out at a wall weirdly. She picks up Ross on doing a look almost to camera.
Right.
It was his third half hour of telly ever.
Yeah.
Ray Charles.
Yeah, I've heard people say, they must have heard it from Craig Charles saying, oh, I wasn't very comfortable with the acting, because you will hear people now go, oh yeah, in the first series, Craig Charles's acting isn't that good, but by series 3 and 4, it was really good. I'm like, no, he was great from the start. He was such a natural. He's brilliant.
Yeah, he was cast to be himself, I think. The problem, if there is a problem, it's when he thinks that his performance needs something more than what he's already giving.
Sure, right.
And actually, yeah, the comfort, he's brilliant. Yeah. Mm. That's what this podcast is, basically. A bunch of people just go, oh, it's brilliant, isn't it?
That was so good, isn't
brilliant.
It?
It's good.
It's quite good, isn't it? I think you should do more episodes of this. I think the show's good.
Yeah,
I think we will. And Suze, you're welcome back anytime, because you have also been
thank you. I would love to. Thank you.
There is one question that I want to ask you.
Sure.
Which is, can you just briefly summarise all of your thoughts about Queen in the 1980s? I'm not going to ask you that. I'll just have to hope that one day that podcast returns.
Second pandemic, instead, fingers crossed.
Yeah, hey, who knows? Maybe it'll be something that eats your flesh.
Yeah, this is something to look forward to. But ask what all the Red Dwarf fans who haven't heard the Queen podcast want to know, which is where can they find Suze Kempner?
Oh, yes, I am at this point in time still on Twitter, now X, because they'll have to tear me out of there with their cold dead hands, etc. So S-O-O-Z.
You probably have to pay them.
Yeah, I will not be paying for it. Basically, if you're listening to this and Twitter, you've heard on the grapevine is behind a paywall, I won't be on there because I refuse to give a penny to Elon Musk. But I am on there mugging him off day after day. S-O-O-Z UK, Suze UK. I'm also on Instagram and Threads and Blue Sky, but unfortunately Twitter's the place I've got the most visibility still. So that's why I'm still there. So yeah, I'm on YouTube, and come and see me live. It's just Google me. I'm the only Suze Kempner, so.
There you go. Go do it. Say nice things. Thank you so much, Suze.
Thanks, Suze.
Thank you. Cheers.
Wasn't Suze Kempner brilliant?
Yeah, delight as per. With 3 episodes in, I'm really enjoying this.
It's great, isn't it?
Like, if anyone has a problem with the whole, like, how would you recast a reboot of the show? Then I hope that just this first batch of recasting has answered that question, which is it's not about the sacrilege of replacing the actors. It really shows you how people see this show and the different perspectives on it. And I loved Suze's return to the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
Like, I want to remake it, but back then with a different cast. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lovely approach. Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole Red Dwarf multiverse out there, it turns out, of just amazing people playing these characters in really, like, signature ways. I love it.
Very revealing psychologically, I imagine.
The fact that someone can just wander in and go, oh, I would cast X person as Lister, and you just go, oh, yeah, that'd be great. And you can sort of see what the version of that, like Daisy May Cooper, I can see that in my head, and it's not it's not her doing a Craig Charles impression, obviously, because that would be absolutely bizarre. but like, it's really vivid to me, and that says so much about, I guess that's why it's worth doing a podcast on this show, because it's much better than you think it is, even when you love it. When you actually stop and make yourself think about why it's so good, it's just a pleasure, isn't it?
How nice to know we can love the same thing in very different ways.
Yeah, that's true. I just want to shout out a moment from this episode. A thing that I think is great is Holly's explanation of why he chose his face. It's the greatest and most prolific lover who ever lived. I think that's awesome. But I have some trivia behind that I didn't mention when we had Suze here. Apparently, Holly was going to be just a voice originally.
Yeah.
And this was the episode where they decided that we should see his face. So presumably they wrote that at that point because they knew that we were going to see him. And then they reshot for the preceding episodes that had been filmed. Obviously, it wasn't broadcast in the same order it was filmed exactly as we've kind of touched on already in other discussions. But yeah, this is the first time anybody would have actually seen the magnificent, sexy Norman Lovett doing his thing.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
in all of his glory.
That's lovely.
I can't imagine it just as a voice. He's got a great voice, but his face adds so much to the character. Mm.
Yeah, I guess they were thinking of, like, Hal.
Yeah, presumably, yeah.
And all the spaceship voices that Sigourney Weaver does.
I think part of the reason he appears on screen is that Norman Lovett was petitioning pretty heavily for it.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Interesting, okay. It's for more profile, presumably.
It was such a success that he doesn't need to be, like, it sounds like ego, but actually it was correct as well. So,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's definitely funnier seeing it. Because you get stuff like that amazing Night Watchman outfit in Queen.
Yeah.
No spoilers. Yeah. Well, that is a spoiler. Actually, now, this is weird. I don't know why, but I spent a little bit of time trying to determine whether I think Lister actually tried to make roast beef and somehow made a gâteau because he's a terrible chef, foreshadowing the fact that he's going to fail, or whether it's a joke.
It has to be, and it is. It like the what was the fifth line of the first episode? The is that a cigarette you're smoking? No, it's a chicken. I think Lister is adept at that kind
of those kind of things. Yeah,
very sardonic for him.
Yeah, like, it's extremely
dry
because
he's extremely.
In any other context, you go, yeah, that's obviously a joke because it's Red Dwarf and weird things happen. I was part of you was going, well, maybe there's some kind of bizarre, futuristic cooking that enables this to happen. Anyway.
But that would surely render the chef's exam pointless.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If you're talking 100%. About, like, programming an AI oven.
God forbid they make this plotline pointless. I mean, that would be awful.
Actually, about this episode, there was one thing, because you started to talk about the balance of power and the theme of that throughout the episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you talking about that was the first time that I really understood that Holly doesn't have any power.
Interesting.
Holly can do anything on the ship, could make anything happen, but he doesn't. He doesn't stop Rimmer. He doesn't control the scutters. Maybe he can't. Maybe Holly doesn't even have a rank. There's 169 crew members. You can bet Holly's not amongst that number, right?
That is true. Although I do wonder, because he says that the physical data disk has become corrupted in this episode and that accounts for Peterson's arm. I don't know if I believe that. I guess his existence is pointless without them, isn't it? So ultimately, he probably could pull a Hal in 2001 and attempt to. But what would be the point? He'd just go even more mad.
Well, it's the iRobot. The outcome of the Asimovian laws, right, is the only way of truly protecting humanity is to make sure there's no humans to protect. Do we see Holly before the stasis leak? We do, right? He comes on screen while the crew is still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right,
he does. Yeah,
that's a weird thing to think about in itself. Not that Norman Lovett is funny and has a funny face and a funny voice and should be on screen being seen and heard, but they chose him. They programmed it. The JMC programmed their ship's computer to be like this. And presumably that impish prankstery quality developed over 3 million years rather than existing at the start of episode one.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So what was the... Why? Why is that? That seems to be the personality that's manifested itself. Maybe he went through lots of iterations and just ended up, like immortals so often do, just completely disconnected and just wanting to play jokes because that's just wanting to amuse yourself, basically.
You've done everything else. Yeah, I mean, wow, actually, yeah, because what if Red Dwarf's been safe for 2 million years, but Holly was just having too much fun and he's finally just got bored and gone, oh, well, I'll just wake that guy up. What was his name again? Lister. Oh, I better give him a companion. Who would be the most entertaining companion I could give him? Oh, that smeghead. Like,
of course,
it could
it's
be.
Been staring us in the face. The whole thing was a prank. The whole thing is about just torturing someone. Red Dwarf conspiracy theory.
The dark timeline.
We've done it. Episode 3, and we've already got...
Right, so who's on next week?
Oh, it's a good one. They're all good. We've got Paul Foxcroft talking about waiting for God.
You could not get a more perfect person on to talk about all of that lore and mythos.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see you there. We won't see you.
It's
an audio medium. Listen.
We'll hear you there. You'll hear us then.
You'll hear us. Exactly. Yeah, smooth.
We're not that good at this bit yet.
We'll get there.
Bye.
It's better than life.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.